Jason and I became a couple. Once, after he bought a new Prius, Jason drove us all the way up to Yosemite to visit my mom, who was visiting her cousin Stella and her husband and son at their home there. Jason played guitar, made us laugh, talked about spirits and horse ghosts rumored to roam the property. My mom got a little bit tipsy and ordered us to take off our shoes. We studied our feet. He had Fred Flintstone feet, he joked. Big, thick, comical, and adorable. I loved them. Stella said they were a sign of a passionate character. We stayed together, off and on, for several years. His mother called me beloved, but I never publicly embraced the relationship as much as I wanted to, because I was ashamed. Not of Jason or my feelings for him, but because I thought I should be getting married, and I didn't want to drag Jason toward that. I didn't necessarily want to get married. I calibrated my expectations based on what I read in magazines or other people's experiences or the pervasive cultural attitude about what someone my age should be doing. I couldn't fully own how I felt about him, worrying that our 8-year age difference must be inappropriate, that my mother wouldn't approve of this match, snatching such a young boy. I imagined I was way more grown up than I was, but I believed at the time that I was already too old for such things like infatuation. I loved the abandon and purity of youth that he represented, but I didn't know how to let myself be a young girl in love. Instead, I kept him somewhat hidden, afraid he would be ruined by Elliot. He was young, but we both were. We got jealous. Things happened. I flirted, as was my habit. He made out with supermodels. Hearts were broken, repaired, broken again. I was hurt by his actions, though they were more age-appropriate than the relationship we were destroying. By the time we were finally ready to be a real couple, we had broken each other apart. We went to see an astrologist. Jason's mother, Talia, was very into astrology, to the point where she consulted the stars as a roadmap to her life. She conferred with the cosmos before making plans. If one of us was going out of town, she would look to the stars to see if it was a good time. She sent the two of us to a highly gifted and reputable advisor who printed out a whole series of charts. As he explained their meanings, I circled the things I found exciting. At the time, all I wanted to know was if Jason and I would weather our age difference and be together forever. The astrologer considered this from every angle. The stars all agreed we would end up heartbroken. Time away, working on a film, allowed me to focus, offering a respite from the cycle of self-flagellation, doubt, loneliness, and neuralgia. But when I was in Prague filming Hellboy, I floundered in my solitude. On my weeks off in the Czech Republic, I resembled a pinball, careening from wall to floor to wall to hallway, and finally gripping pillars, holding arches carved out of stone, from catacombs to car, to bar, to bed, to bathroom, crying to myself out loud on the floor. Sometimes I lost myself in the comfort of memories of my time with Jason. We had a rocky farewell. After time apart, I knew we were done, but I couldn't let him go. Late one night, as I sat in my trailer, smoking countless cigarettes and grieving my loss while playing Under Pressure by Queen and David Bowie, I called Jason for what must have been the 40th time that week. It always went to voicemail, the dreaded click to beep. But that night he picked up, his voice. Both my heart and my gut froze. "Finally," I whispered, my spirit on the precipice. I knew there was a vastness before us, but I did not see the turning away to come. He was clear and resolute. Love and heartbreak had grown him up. And then, the little black flip phone in my hand, the only channel to him for months ahead, was of no use. There was no more. I knew. The brown carpeting and the bright bulbs from the vanity mirror squiggled and shimmied through big fat tears. I was the architect of my own misery. There would be no reconciling. I went on set and cried in Guillermo's arms and haunted the streets of Prague until I went back to nothing in Los Angeles. I had never felt more sure my whole future would be a loss now. Heartsick, I flooded myself with champagne and vodka. Fresh mojitos in dark bars in the old part of town. I drank, surrounded by girls made up like prostitutes. Pale, skinny, tacky, glamorous. Faded already and not even 20. Men in square-toed loafers stepped on my feet, sliding past. These were the bars I left every night, out onto the Charles Bridge, as the beggars cried on their knees, shrouded in black robes, silent and bowed. In the morning, I'd report to set and perform in a big movie. I was crushed, silenced. I didn't see the miracle that was my life. I didn't see the wins, the fabulous directors, the famous friends. I saw only heartbreak. I didn't believe I would recover. July 29th to 30th, 2:15 a.m. Wrap later today. This journey is almost over. A memory. The pain and growing I have gone through in Prague is immense. Love. Shooting Hellboy 2 several years later, and still grieving, I called him one more time. That's when I accepted it was over for good. We spoke. He told me he was in a great relationship with the woman who would later become his wife, Brady. He was happy. He was so clear in his devotion to her that my heart found grace and was healed. I loved him enough. I realized that I actually felt relief. He forgave me and wished me well, he said. Then we said goodbye. Not too long ago, my son, Arthur, and I ran into Jason at the drugstore. He was carrying a big box of diapers. Arthur asked, "What's that?" To which Jason replied, "Pillows. I come here to get my pillows." My son laughed, and I thought, wow, this did not end badly after all. This ended perfectly. Finally. Even as my acting career continued, as lovers came and went, as friendships deepened or trickled off and time marched on, I would return to drinking. To be clear, I did not drink on set. When I worked, I was totally sober. Those were sacred moments where I was given a job and I did it. But left to my own devices, I let sleep, sadness, and drink take over. I'd go for periods when I didn't drink at all or didn't drink as much. And then I'd go all in again, crippled with pain and fatigue, binging until I passed out, welcoming oblivion. Before shooting Storytelling in New York, I wound up going back to rehab for a second time. I wanted to go. It was my idea. I didn't feel safe with myself. I was worried about my overall health. I entered the Sierra Tucson Center for treatment of my alcohol addiction and depression. The intake nurse reviewed my form and assigned me to the eating disorder unit. I told them I didn't have an actual eating disorder, which I thought true. While I knew I wasn't one to nourish myself adequately, I did not feel I had an eating disorder. Though I did mind my weight, I didn't count calories. I didn't starve myself. My middle school years were another story. I didn't follow any of the patterns that accompany disordered eating, but I doth protest too much. Ironically, The experience gave me a full-blown eating disorder for a long time. I substituted an eating disorder for drinking. The people I met there taught me how. Everyone sat around obsessing about calories, competitive with weighing and measuring and packets of artificial sweeteners. I became embarrassed to gain weight there, and I was given less to eat than I normally would have because they didn't want to trigger me. I see now that it was always in me, latent, waiting. I just needed someone to prompt me to be better at it, to compete. Once I left the program, regulating my own starvation became a bigger theme in my life. I read the book Stick Figure, not as a cautionary tale about the danger of eating disorders, but as a how-to guide. It was like encountering Sarah T. all over again, trading out shots of vodka for withholding food. On the other hand, I did stay sober for a while, but it would not be for good. Alcohol had been the salve, the relief, the warmth. I thought I found a way to stay on this planet with my wine, but the electric anxiety and loneliness found a friend to creep around with in the dark halls. Alone in my bedroom, I was like Alice, sampling what the order, drink me, could bring. Nothing good. Wink. There are dapples of light in my story all along the way. Wink was one of them. When I was still with Jason, I suffered a bout of despair and chronic trigeminal neuralgia that had me searching for a distraction. So I took a volunteer job walking dogs at a local animal shelter, the Lang Foundation. There was this mutt, a forgotten one-eyed corgi mix named Wink. She could not stop jumping whenever I walked past. She reminded me of a Hanna-Barbera cartoon doggy on a pogo stick. At night, alone in my house, I couldn't stop thinking about her delightful, boundless joy. She bounced around in my head, even in my dreams. One bright morning, over buckwheat pancakes at Quality, I asked Jason what he thought about taking Wink home for a night. And then I'll write a glowing personal report to pin on her crate at the shelter to help charm a potential forever home adopter, I said. When we went to collect her for the overnight evaluation, I had little intention of keeping her. I'd never taken care of a dog on my own before, and besides, I didn't want the added responsibility as I tried to build a career and stay awake, really. On our way home in his Prius, with Wink snuggled happily next to me in the front seat, we stopped by Jason's mother's house. Talia wanted to meet her, and Wink replied in kind. This is a great dog, Talia shouted as her three pugs and Wink chased one another around the lawn. You have to keep this dog, Selma, she insisted, before she adjourned inside to read more Pirandello, still grieving her beloved late husband, Jack. I took Wink home that night, and with me she stayed. It was a miracle to have found her. She was my Steinbeck companion, my travels with Wink. Everybody loved Wink. Wink, who once ate an entire pumpkin pancake from my plate at La Conversation with such swiftness, I never even saw her do it. She sat contentedly on my lap through so many meals, eyeing my steak frites, ever hopeful. She sat quietly in my lap, still while makeup artists readied me for camera away on location. She accompanied me on every trip into every movie set, for every sleep, and every waking. When I was overwhelmed by melancholy and wiped out for weeks, she brought me mice and rats and even a possum. Loyal little dog was she, staying tucked beside me when I retreated to my bed or howled in pain, whether from a broken heart or the pain in my face or from missing my mother. She was a dear witness to all of it. The happiest dog I've ever known, fearful only in thunderstorms. One spring night in Budapest, while I was filming Hellboy 2, the sky cracked with lightning and driving rain. As Wink trembled in my arms, I hummed deeply into her heart, the vibration soothing her to sleep. Guillermo del Toro honored her in the film by naming a character after her. I cared for her as tenderly as I would a human child, cherished her above all else, every night and every morning, gently kissing her and thanking my angels for her company. I could not imagine a life without her. Carrie. Meeting Carrie Fisher was another bright spot. As soon as she found me, life grew softer. My world felt kinder and more exciting with her in it. Now, I should preface this by saying, I was not a Princess Leia fangirl. I'd seen Star Wars in the theater when it was first released. Lizzie, Katie, Mom, Dad, and me. I enjoyed it. The famous font scrolling by, accompanied by the dramatic sweeping building orchestra. C-3PO lost in the blurry haze of the desert. Katie liked C-3PO best. He was skinny like her. Lizzie was Chewbacca, cute and strong. I was relegated to being R2-D2 because we were both the smallest. I was not amused by this. My parents bought me a shirt with an R2-D2 decal on it, and I was so upset that I screamed and screamed until my mother locked me in my room. That was the only time I can recall her doing that, although Katie would trap me often. But the Force, I missed the whole point. May the Force be with you, became my rosary, my mantra, my wish. In my young eyes, Darth was the real star. The cape, the breathing, the mask, a presence, dramatic, frightening, imperious. Who wanted to be R2-D2 when you could be Darth? That, to me, was the true meaning of the Force. He reminded me of my mother. Fast forward to 2001, at a Women in Hollywood luncheon. Cruel Intentions and Legally Blonde had put me on the map. I was dating Jason Schwartzman, deeply in love. I was riding high and thin from late 1990s fame, thinking the world would only keep getting better. I was wearing a gray Jane Mail dress that Jason had purchased for me on the advice of his cousin, Sofia Coppola. Gucci boots, a vintage Hermes Kelly bag on my arm. The parking lot of the Beverly Hills Four Seasons swarmed with gorgeous, important women. One of them came running up to me from across the way. I didn't recognize her at first. She was middle-aged, attractive. Her long scarf trailed behind her, where it latched onto the back of her shoe like toilet paper. She was comical, dropping things, carrying on, adorable. As she got closer, I realized the woman was Carrie Fisher. She looked right into my eyes, grabbed my arm, and said, "Oh, it's my birthday. Please come to my party." Bruce Wagner, her tall, handsome sidekick, wearing a boiler suit, took my number for her and promised to call me with her address. The citizens of Los Angeles can be flaky, so I was pleased when he actually did. Jason was a huge Star Wars aficionado, so we went. We drove out to her home, a sprawling estate off Coldwater Canyon. It had once been owned by Betty Davis, followed by the Academy Award-winning costume designer Edith Head. Carrie had it redone in a colorful, kitschy way, filling every inch with London flea market finds and folk art. As we drove up the driveway, signs pleaded, "Please do not enter." They looked as if they were written by charming trolls. A chandelier glimmered from a tree, and tiny bulbs twinkled in all the lace-bowed branches. There was a swimming pool with an old-fashioned slide way up on the hill. The whole place was whimsical, marvelous. Every corner of the house told a story of her life. Jason and I walked into the party arm in arm. Carrie greeted us, so genuine and friendly. "Don't stand too close to each other. You'll look like garden gnomes," she quipped in a good-natured joke about our short stature. She reminded me she was once married to Paul Simon, and together they reminded her of salt and pepper shakers. The people whose work I admired on screen were suddenly mingling about. George Lucas waited in line for the bathroom, Michael Keaton at the bar, Robert Downey Jr. on the bar. but not drinking any longer. Meg Ryan, looking like Meg Ryan, dressed in her combat boots and tights, Tracy Ullman and Taya Leone and David Duchovny. It was like the Mad Hatter's Tea Party come to life, a who's who of the old guard. After that party, Carrie was in my life as though she'd been there all along. We'd smoke cigarettes in her bed and watch Turner Classic Movies as she wrote on her yellow pad. She always kept one by her side, as my mother used to do. Now I do, too. Carrie was very skilled at her trade. She knew she had to fucking write. So she sat on her bed and she wrote. Every now and then, she'd look up and go on these riffs. I'd roar. She was so enthusiastic. Sometimes she'd get dark in her writing. She'd read a passage aloud and I'd suggest edits. You're right, you have to leave room for the laughter, she'd say, nodding, trying to build up my confidence. Sometimes, like with my mother, she'd admire one of my quips. Always, she wanted to help me, knowing I was not yet ready in life. We'd have long dinners, her stained glass light boxes of saints glowing behind us. She knew a little about every subject under the sun, the most brilliant wit. One night, while talking about the filmmaker Buñuel, she stopped mid-sentence and said, "Ah, let's go down to Mom's house and scare her." Her mother, Debbie Reynolds, lived on the property. Once Carrie got an idea in her head, she ran with it, full steam. We'd slink around and play Ding Dong Ditch and dress up in her Leia costume drinking Diet Coke. One of the best parts of Carrie's world was that you didn't have to be polite. You could just be you, messy and raw. I felt compelled to fill the silence, but Carrie justified everything. She would wave her hands and say, "Who cares?" At Carrie's house, you could wander around. You could say what popped up. You could go deep, talk about something for 20 minutes, have a Diet Coke and maybe a cigarette outside while she dropped glitter on my head, and then leave. Or you could stay forever. She didn't have expectations. Carrie took the responsibility off things. She knew how to make people comfortable. She was the kind of friend I could handle. Plus, she sent a good email. No one sends a good email anymore. She signed them all to me, Leia. We would talk about being misunderstood. "I know," she'd say. "It's all a misunderstanding. And all of it is true." After attending a couple of Carrie's gatherings, I noticed that she often made her way to bed, even before the party was over. She really did try to live each day, but she struggled. Sometimes she'd disappear into the bathroom and come back talking gibberish. I never asked a question, never brought up the pills. I respected her too much, and I didn't feel it was my place. We never once drank together. We never once took a pill together. Only once ever did Carrie see me drunk. It happened to be the last real time I saw her. Arthur was a toddler. I'd checked us into Shutters on the beach in Santa Monica for a night of relaxation. The front desk sent up a bottle of champagne. I wasn't drinking much then, but that day I was sobbing uncontrollably about some child-proofing issue I was nervous about. I would fall into spasms of sobs unprovoked, and it could all be too much. I couldn't stop crying. So I poured a glass. I decided, why not? This was the first of only two times in my life when I drank in front of my son. At one point, I stumbled down the hall, already exhausted again, a champagne flute in one hand, Arthur balanced on my hip. And there was Carrie, walking with Bruce Wagner. We screamed and squealed and hugged. She was such a hugger. Unlike my mother, she loved human touch. We couldn't believe it. We couldn't believe it. We hugged again and again. I didn't want to let her go. She invited me to come up to her room. "Bring Arthur," she said. But all I wanted to do was hide in my room and cry and drink. So we hugged once more, swaying back and forth in each other's arms, and that was it. We walked away, promising I would make it to her room. I did not. A couple weeks before she died, I was at Barnes & Noble in LA with Arthur. my then beau Ron, and his daughter, Chloe. When I noticed all the characters from Star Wars wandering around the store, I went up to a guy dressed as Boba Fett and asked him, "What is this? What's going on?" In a voice muffled by his armor, he said, "It's for Carrie Fisher's book party." I squealed, "Carrie's book party?" It was a huge crowd. There were so many costumes, so many Carrie Fisher admirers. I gave Boba Fett's female companion a message. "If you get a chance to meet Carrie, please tell her I was here, but I have to go get my son home." Later that night, Boba Fett's friend found me on social media and sent me a note. "I gave Carrie your message, and she said, 'God damn it, where is that bitch?' And then she called out looking for you. Bitch, bitch, where are you?" I laughed and wrote back, "I hope you told her this bitch had already gone." I pictured her standing on a chair, searching the rows and rows of books, trying to find me in the crowd, just as she had years before. I was home alone when I found out she'd gone into cardiac arrest on a plane and was in a coma. It was Christmas time, and I'd just put up our tree. I sat next to it and sobbed. She died 4 days later, on December 27th, 2016. When I heard the news, I couldn't breathe. Someone once told me that grief is love you can no longer express. And that's certainly how I felt about the loss of Carrie. I loved her. I did take Carrie for granted. I thought she would always be there. She was larger than my life. I didn't think she would ever go. I didn't think. I really, really miss her. We were true loners, Carrie and I. Real recluses. But because of her, I learned how to listen. Because of her, I learned that it's good to idolize the people who are here now, the ones who really mean something. Because of her, I try to always say, "I love you" to those I take for granted. Because of her, I keep a tree lit and decorated with ornaments all year round, as she did, her Leia figure hidden in the plastic branches. I didn't go to her funeral. The only person who would have invited me to it was Carrie herself, and she was dead. We'd never worked together. I wasn't on anyone's list. I was only on Carrie's list. They'd put her ashes in a Prozac bottle, a kitschy object from an old pharma display. She would have laughed. The loss was so huge. When there was an auction of some of her things, I bought her dollhouse, her trinkets, the molded modern furniture, her light-up St. Francis, her hanging Lucite chair. I couldn't bear the thought of her things going to anyone else. I wanted to hold on to her. I spent too much money on it all, just as she did. "It's expensive being Carrie Fisher," she lamented once. I did talk to Carrie on the night before her funeral. I told her I wanted to leave a rock on her gravesite. We both had Jewish fathers, and that's what Jews do. "I have to bring a rock," I said out loud. "I need a heart-shaped crystal." And I swear I heard her voice reply, "Please don't leave a heart-shaped crystal. Just write something, you lazy asshole." "I don't own any yellow legal pads," I said to her. "And I don't have anything to say." Missing her voice, I started to reread her memoir, Shockaholic, but it was too fucking painful. I put the book down, thinking I'd get to it later. I placed it on the far side of the room, right next to a lamp she'd given me. And then I forgot about it. A few days later, I went back over to the book. Right on top of it, there was a big, amorphous crystal. It was a smoky quartz. And if you look at it just so, you can see it's in the shape of a jagged heart. As soon as I saw it, I started shaking. A feeling of warmth washed over me. I felt her presence. I screamed, "Oh my God, Carrie Fisher, you're real!" A voice back, "Fuck you, I'm real." "This is so special," I responded. "I'll never tell anyone about this. I have told anyone who will listen." After Carrie died, I met with the clairvoyant medium, Tyler Henry. I felt unmoored after losing her, and I wanted to talk to her. I needed a bedtime story. I was so intent on meeting him that at one point I actually called E!, the network that airs his show, Hollywood Medium, and said, "I'm going to go on the show if that's the only way to get a reading." And that is exactly what happened. I do believe that some people can see spirits, the same way I can see lint on other people's jackets that they don't seem to notice. Personally, I've never seen a spirit, and aside from the day I found Carrie's rock, I've never felt a spirit, but I am open to it. The reading took place in my home. I brought Tyler three objects connected to loved ones: Bradley Bluestone's photo, the crystal Carrie left me, and a picture of Wink. I set them down in front of him, with the photos turned over so he could see only the backs. The first thing we discussed was my career. "I'm ready to get back," I told him. I'd been feeling stalled, sick, weak for years, and I needed good news. "I don't really see you acting," he said. "You're going to be more of an advocate." This was not what I wanted to hear. "Oh, fuck no," I laughed. "I am not a giver like that. I am a privileged, miserable white woman who struggles with depression, so I can't even offer a self-help spin. Advocate for what?" This was before my MS diagnosis, and I could never have predicted what was coming. He was right, of course, just as he was with Alan Thicke's impending heart attack. We started with the objects. Tyler picked up on everything from Brad. He felt Wink come through loud and clear. "Wink," he said without any prompting. He said he'd never had such a big energy between dog and person. He told me Wink was so glad I made a memorial for her, and I began to cry. I thought, out of everything, Carrie's rock would explode, but Tyler held it, and nothing happened. He shook his head. "I don't see anything. I'm not getting anything from it at all." To this day, I have no accounting for that crystal and its appearance. It is the only instance in my life, aside from making a baby, that was my one real account of magic. When I saw it, I picked it up and felt such a warmth in my chest. It was so tangible. The rock is still here, but it doesn't have the magic anymore. Almost like an expired birthday wish. I let time dissipate my belief it was really from her. "You know," Tyler said, putting the rock back down, "this reminds me of the time Beverly D'Angelo wanted to talk to Carrie Fisher. She wouldn't come through. She just didn't want to be public anymore." "Oh, Carrie, I apologize." The Julies. When I look back through my childhood diaries, it's mostly about boys. Boy after boy after boy. And misery. And body pains. What did I do wrong? How can I get him to like me? What could I do to keep him? And my face burns. I can't take this pain. I had it all backward. I was looking for help, love. I wasn't even looking for attention or approval. I was looking for a Julie, a soulmate, a confidant, someone who sees me for who I am and loves me in spite of it all. I collect Julies. Everyone needs a Julie, but preferably a handful. A Julie is one of those stable, well-adjusted, loving, and utterly grounded women who comes into your life and makes it better in every way. I owe the major steps of my life to the Julies of the world. As much as is humanly possible, I surround myself with their love. I met my first Julie on the first day of Cranbrook Kingswood. This Julie was actually Sue. She was everything I wasn't: blonde, tall, good to the bone, properly ambitious in life. After high school, my friends, Kelly and Fran and Chip, and I revered her so much that whenever we found a good person, we'd call her a Sue. When I moved to Los Angeles, I met another Sue, but her name was Lisa, and she stayed by my side, sharing my adventures over a glass of wine. Then I met Julie when I moved to my first house. Now, whenever I meet a good person, I call her a Julie. The house on Cynthia Street was a charming little bungalow, once a pied-à-terre for Groucho Marx's mistress. The day I moved, in the summer of 2001, a little girl, a precious sprite with long brown hair named Anna, came over to say hello. She bounded up the driveway, trailed by her mother, to give me a welcome hug. The affection from that girl has never wavered. But the greatest gift was the woman standing behind her, her mother, Julie DeSanto, whose three other kids and husband, Elio, were waiting at home, next door. Julie brought out home-cooked Italian meals, welcomed me into her family, became my confidant and my cheerleader. She and Elio owned a restaurant in LA for years, and she was a devoted mother who ran what was basically a daycare out of her house so she could be with her four children. After her kids were grown, she followed her calling to become a trauma therapist. I watched in awe as she transformed her family and her life through her understanding of how trauma and pain are held in the body and how we can recover from them. In December 2015, I met another Julie. I had just started working on a film called Mothers and Daughters, and my life was in a desperate place. I had been experiencing aggravated, unidentified MS symptoms for years, and I was really in bad shape. I probably weighed 85 pounds, if that, and was in constant pain with tight, burning, inflamed skin. My financial situation wasn't much better. I hadn't worked since 2013, when I was fired from anger management after I called Charlie Sheen a menace to work with. At least that's what I read. I was broke. My funds had dwindled so much, I shouldn't even have splurged on going out to dinner. This job offered me 3 paid weeks in LA. On the first day of work, the car showed up with a young, pretty woman at the wheel, ready to transport me. She wore a big parka and sensible running shoes. Her name was Bonnie. During the next few weeks, she cheerfully and skillfully managed my life on that shoot, taking everything in stride. She made sure a constant supply of nourishing snacks was eaten by me. She was extremely capable and grounded. In other words, she was a Julie. I learned she'd been a Montessori teacher for 5 years, but had burned out and, like me, she was looking for a change. In the car home one evening, we discussed life plans. She came on as my assistant and stayed by my side through it all. She was and is a beautiful and reliable woman. It was as if she'd been sent to me by some benevolent force in the universe. I don't know what I would have done without her at this time. So now everyone who knows me calls the good people in their lives a Julie. Another piece of advice: find yourself a Julie. Those guardian angels who walk among us. And then hold on to her. I first saw the ethereal brand of Julie known as Jamie King on a magazine cover in 1996 with a story by Jennifer Egan titled James is a Girl. I fell in love. I'm a sucker for beauty, and she has one of those faces that made me grateful and envious. Grateful that such a face exists. Anxious it wasn't mine. Later, in California, Jamie and I auditioned for the same role in the movie Slackers. Angela, the pretty girl. And she got the part. Jason Schwartzman was also cast. And suddenly, Instead of admiration, I felt jealousy. Not only did I think Jamie was heartbreakingly gorgeous, but certainly my boyfriend would too. I'll never forget the name Angela, because Jason had to shave an A into his chest hair as part of the movie. Now I saw the A in the shower, and when we were intimate, a constant reminder of this girl who is now playing the girl who steals my love's heart. I drove to Riverside to visit him on set, but I accidentally passed the exit, driving hours out of my way. By the time I arrived, I was hungry and dehydrated. When I saw Jamie in person, I couldn't believe there was a creature so beautiful. She was Grace Kelly, a young Brooke Shields, perfection magnified. It was otherworldly. She wore Birkenstocks, and all I could think was, of course they look good on her. When I wore mine, I looked very Seattle coffee bean, or as my mother said, like a potato picker. But they looked stylish on her. Oh, allure. When I saw how perfectly she presented, even in a Birkenstock, I excused myself from set. If ever she and Jason had dinner in his room together, I became paranoid. Don't trust her, I told him. Don't be alone with her. I'd never seen her act inappropriately toward him, but she was friendly, flirty. What's her deal? I grilled him. Why does she want to be alone with you? Whenever I went to set, I grew silent and judgmental. Eventually, I saw she'd done nothing. I'd been making her into something she wasn't. A couple months later, I called her from the bathtub, where I went to think. You know, I'm really jealous of you, I admitted. I apologized for being cold and distrustful, and Jamie was true. Thank you so much, she said, with so much grace. She offered me a lot of grace. From there, we fell in love, as young close friends do. I had a dream the world was ending. Gravity had disappeared, and everyone was slipping into space. In this dream world, as I tried to hang on, I noticed that I was holding Jamie's hand. In the morning, Jamie called me. I had a dream about you, she said. I dreamed that I was holding your hand. Ever since, it's been understood that we are sisters of a sort. I love her. She pulls through for everything. She's generous beyond. She's a real seeker of things. She's a long hugger, maybe a little too long. Julie always said everyone should hug for 9 seconds to really feel it. But 9 seconds is a long time. Still, as with most things, Jamie easily gets away with it. Minutes, hours, years. Holding on to me, please. Amit. I did get married once. It happened in part because of a horoscope. I was 32 at the time, a rag doll, way too depressed and exhausted, still living in the aftermath of my ruined relationship with Jason Schwartzman, the love of my young life. One day, my friend Amanda Anka asked me, "Who are you dating?" I was very much not dating anyone. "I think I have your husband," she said. "Really? Who?" I asked. "Amit Zappa." She waited for my reaction. "The bald guy who was on MTV?" Not the reaction she was hoping for. "He has a crush on you," she said. "He just asked me, when are you going to introduce me to my wife?" So I met Amit for breakfast at Hugo's in West Hollywood. His first impression of me was that I looked like, as he put it, a brown clown. Like my mother before me, I am heavy-handed with a blush brush, which I believe is the sign of either an insane woman or a great artist. I was trying to look sun-kissed, but instead I showed up caked in bronzer. "Hello, brown clown," he said when I sat down. We got engaged 8 days later. Amit was sweet. He had a kind face and big, warm eyes with lashes like a snuffleupagus. When he blinked, I felt like Beyonce with my very own wind machine. He was tall and cuddly, inappropriate with a remark, and fun. With his friends, we made up stories that we told in silly accents. I played a woman named Donatella who made hoop skirts for ponies. This hoop skirt is the height of fashion for the pony who wants more girth. Amit laughed and laughed. The week after we met, I took him to my Julie's house. She approved, and we all cozied up in her daughter's room as the girls got ready for bed, laughing together, which made me happy. Deeply entrenched in that new couple glow, we picked up a book, a Zodiac book on astrological love matches. It was one of those tomes you find for $1.99 on the bargain shelf at Barnes & Noble. The book told us that Taurus and Cancer were the ideal match. He was a Taurus. I was a Cancer. Clearly, I was someone who had trouble straying from a forecast. Whatever the prophecy was, I felt I had an obligation to fulfill it. When we got in the car, Amit asked, "Will you marry me?" I laughed and said, "What?" A moment passed. I could see he was serious. So I giggled again and said, "Well, where's the offering?" He fumbled in the glove box, found a yellow highlighter pen, and repeated, "Will you marry me?" It was so Zappa, very impulsive. I thought, this is what I need. Someone spontaneous. Someone who is going to jump off the edge for me, because I'm pretty far down. I was happy that it was written in the stars. With Amit, I could wipe off my brown clown and be myself. So I accepted the highlighter. And just like that, we were engaged. After I said yes, Amit remembered how his father, Frank, had proposed to his mother, Gail, with a ballpoint pen. It was another sign. This match was meant to be. Why I thought either of these stories was romantic instead of hasty and impulsive, I do not know. We were two loving people who hadn't yet found their person. We walked in blindfolded but holding hands. When I called my mother to tell her the big news, she sighed loudly. "Oh, Selma." Then she asked, "Who are his people?" "He's a Zappa," I said. Still, she was indignant. "Well, I'm not going to throw you a wedding when you're only going to get divorced. You're like me. You're not meant to be married." Ever the rebel, I did it anyway, though her words haunted me. The whole wedding was somewhat wonderfully ridiculous, as many of these things are. I was shooting a John Waters movie with Tracy Ullman at the time, and when I announced to her that we were engaged, she immediately called Carrie Fisher, with whom she was close. On speakerphone, she screamed, "Carrie, Carrie, Carrie, are you there? I have Selma here. Don't you want her to get married at your house?" And that's exactly what happened. Carrie Fisher generously offered to host my wedding at her home when she was strong-armed into it by a trio of celebrants. Carl offered to make my wedding gown, which Vogue, under Anna Wintour, covered in a piece by Plum Sykes. I went to his studio in Paris for the fitting. He drew a simple column in a very pale pink, with rhinestones on the satin ribbons wrapping around my neck and down my back. At first, I protested. "No, no, this is my wedding. I want a big, giant fairy princess ball gown." But Carl said, without skipping a beat, "Darling, the ball gown will be for your next wedding." He made an identical dress in black for the party, so I could drink red wine without concern. Our rehearsal dinner was held at the Chateau Marmont. Everyone in attendance had a copy of Carrie Fisher's latest book, The Best Awful, which had just come out. It was dusk, and we were about to play drag queen bingo with prizes donated by Carrie from her eclectic personal collection. My mother appeared at the door of the bungalow, backlit by the evening sun. She looked very, very shaken. Helmut Newton just dropped dead, my mother announced. Here, right in front of me. Soon after, the food arrived, and the meat in the burgers was still frozen because the kitchen had gone into a tailspin after Newton's heart attack. He was a resident, and they were horrified. And boom, this is the part where the fortune tellers weigh in, and the signs are clear. The universe was telling me to run. Nothing felt right. I felt sick. I wanted to go home, back to Michigan, with my mother and Sue, Kelly and Francis, my Fab Four group from high school. Instead, I picked up a glass. I found someone's abandoned red wine and drank what was left. I sorted my fishtail linen skirt, which I'd bought in Milan with Lizzie and her husband while on a break from shooting Hellboy in Prague, and tightened my ponytail. Well, I thought, at least my mother will go home having witnessed something memorable, Helmut Newton's death. The wedding itself was small, around 40 guests. I didn't invite many people because I don't think I actually believed I was getting married. The entire guest list was made up of my closest friends from Cranbrook, my sisters, Reese, Troy, Julie, Jamie. My heart wasn't in any of it. Apparently, neither was Carrie's. She forgot all about the wedding time and showed up at her own home after the ceremony was over, after having a fresh salon cut. Our engagement might have been written in the stars, but believe you me, a year into that marriage, I went to see another intuitive. But in the end, I couldn't really get answers. How was I supposed to know if I should get out of the marriage when I barely understood how I'd gotten into it? After the wedding, Amit and I traveled around Europe and Japan for the Hellboy press tour. In the Frankfurt airport, Amit bought me a brown stuffed rabbit he named Snoobles. We got along well on that trip, relishing the company and the music and the food, the smell of chocolate in Zurich, the clean air. We were young and hopeful, and we really did love each other. But there was no deep sexual attraction between us. It wasn't totally foolish, but it wasn't built for the long term. We should have been goofy friends who saw each other for dinner every 2 years, joking about what a fun couple we'd make, then going on our merry way. We might have done that if we were not so impulsive, so wanting, so wounded. Our relationship did not provide the comfort I needed. Once I married Amit, the emptiness came back. I lost hope and drive. I didn't know what I wanted to do, how I could secure another good job on screen. I felt sad and terrified, claustrophobic. I had trouble sleeping. I would sob and laugh at the same time, or wake myself in paroxysms of grief. It felt as if I were falling apart. It felt like a slow treading of water, of things falling away. I couldn't keep up mentally or physically. I didn't recognize myself. I was in bed, undercover, literally and figuratively, swollen, wet with constant tears. I started drinking, and I wanted to drink alone. I didn't recognize how fragile I'd become, or that it would ever change. My spirit couldn't get comfortable in my shell-shocked, love-torn, glass, near-empty mindset, and I couldn't wake up. By the end of the marriage, I was drinking at lunch, drunk by dinner. I wanted a divorce, I told him seriously. We had just come home from Julie's grad school graduation and reception. She was going to be a trauma specialist. It was evident she was living the life she wanted, and it made me realize, in stark relief, that I wasn't living the life I wanted. I still didn't know what the fuck I wanted. All I knew was that I wanted to be drunk and be done with this marriage. Amit and I did try. Together, we went to therapy. Eventually, he gave in to my request for a divorce. In the end, we had an important, short relationship that wasn't meant to be. When I called my mother to tell her that Amit and I were divorcing, I made sure to lead with the part where she was correct. "You were right, Mom," I said. "I shouldn't have gotten married. I'm not capable of so much compromise." "That's okay," she said. "At least I didn't pay for that wedding, and my God, your hair was awful. Good thing you didn't invite anybody. Now that's over. Like Carl said, the next one, maybe you will fix your hair next time. Do you have to pay him alimony? I hope you had a prenup. Silly." Just silly. I still love you." After we split, I decided that was it. My mother was right. I wasn't meant to be married. I would never make that mistake again. I hadn't changed my name to Zappa, so I didn't need to give it back. The responsibility of being a Zappa, with my personality, hit too close. I did get stationary with my married name, though. Selma James Blair Zappa. Sometimes I still use it. Every now and then, I'll write to someone, giving them that unexpected gift of history. Bite me. With the exception of high school or spring break, where everyone does stupid things, I hardly ever drank around other people. I was not a social drinker. "How much did you drink?" a friend would ask. "Nothing," I would shrug. I didn't get publicly sloppy from booze very often. I didn't want to make mistakes. I already felt bizarre and uncomfortable, and I didn't need alcohol to exacerbate those qualities for all to worry or judge. For me, the act of drinking was only ever a last resort, more like a common resort, a way to pass out and go into the void. One night, after my divorce, I was at the Chateau Marmont, drink in hand, and lo and behold, there was Sienna Miller. Everyone had told me how much I would love Sienna, and she didn't disappoint. She had such a great smile, with a dimple and white teeth. I couldn't begrudge her for any part she was winning over me. So I grabbed her arm and bit it, playfully, as if it were an apple. Even as I held her forearm in my mouth, I was aghast at myself. I thought, what have I gotten myself into? Or her? This is horrible behavior. Followed closely by, "Please, Selma, please don't leave the house again." I have very sharp canines, but Sienna couldn't have been more charming. She kind of screamed, "Opa," as I do whenever someone breaks a plate. "You bit me, didn't you? You really did," she said in her charming accent. She didn't shame me. For this, in my book, she will forever be the belle of the ball. There was another such incident that did not go as well. The thought of it still makes me redden. Scarlett Johansson and I had met while working on the movie In Good Company, and were on our way to becoming friends, when she invited me on a trip to Las Vegas with a group of her friends. I didn't hesitate to accept. It started out well enough. We got to fly on a private plane. I liked her friends. The room was great. On our first night there, we all went downstairs for great sushi. Because I wasn't good at social drinking, I did not realize how drunk one can get while seated at a table, eating. In fact, it's quite possible the last time I'd done it was that Passover Seder all those years ago. One minute I was sitting there feeling fine. The next I stood up and I was right back at Pete's Tavern. I was the kind of drunk where you're crawling off the stool and the room is spinning, and finding your way to the bathroom feels like circumnavigating the globe. After dinner, we needed to make an appearance at some very loud club. I did my best to work it out, dancing half-heartedly, Paris Hilton style. I was wearing a dress and cape by the row, and I remember reminding myself how Ashley Olsen would advise I go to bed. This didn't have to be. My friend, The actor Seth Green was at the club that night, and he came up to me and said, "I want you to meet my friend." He proceeded to introduce me to Seth MacFarlane. I love Seth MacFarlane. I was starstruck. What do I do in public situations where I admire someone but feel as if I don't bring anything to the party? I bit him on the hand. "Whoa," he yelled, "that really hurt." It wasn't a disaster. I didn't break skin, but I soon hated myself. The following week, there was a story in The Enquirer about how I met Seth MacFarlane and how shocked he was when I bit him. The story did not die there. Seth was the voice of Johan in Hellboy 2, and he told Guillermo del Toro the same story. "Did you really bite him, Monkey Brain?" Guillermo later asked me. Monkey Brain was a nickname he gave me because my eyes cross when sleepy. By the time of this telling, I had been sober for a while, but the story lived on. Anytime I met anyone connected with Seth, which is not a small number of people, I would ask, "Do you know I bit him?" And invariably, they would say, "Yeah." Scarlett has never invited me anywhere since. The truth is, I am a person who is meant to stay home and read books, maybe have a nice dinner, and then put myself to bed. That is the life I'm built for. It's all about the setting. When I'm out in public, it's as if my system gets overwhelmed and instantaneously short circuits. I turned the phoenix into ashes by accident in small ways all the time. In my life, social interactions have been cumbersome. I worried about my mental state for a long time because I didn't yet understand that the MS symptoms accruing over the years were something real. I just thought, "My God, I'm a fucking mess. Falling and dramatic, affable or ridiculous in public. To my family, I'm brooding and quiet. To the world, I'm like Phyllis Diller in drag, attention-seeking and big. I'm a loner, but when I talk to people, I overcompensate and try to give them their money's worth, even if no one asked and no one paid. But it doesn't always have the intended effect. I get overstimulated, unreadable. Thank goodness there are the Sienna Millers of the world, those who are willing to play, those who are willing to see. Once a person has patience for me, I calm down. But first, I throw everything at the wall trying to see what sticks, trying to connect. I'm a slow burn. Someone has to really like me in order to be with me. It's just one of the reasons I love the friends I have so much, the ones who understood me and loved me just the same. The first and only person to bite me back was Kate Moss. Kate and I were friends of a sort through Robert Rich. In the heyday of Marc Jacobs, he was the PR director and celebrity liaison for the brand, and he held court from his basement office on Mercer Street. Some of my best days were spent in that basement, taking Polaroids, drinking rosé out of a can, an inner circle. "You're Kate Moss," I said when I first met her. But my intimidation melted quickly because she was so fucking funny and cool. For a stretch of time, whenever she came to New York or whenever I went to London, we would hang out. After a Marc Jacobs show, a bunch of us were lounging around in a big suite at Claridge's London. I had just started taking Adderall again, which I was prescribed for depression. It worked, in a way, because it got me out of bed. It also made me able to drink more. That night and well into the morning, Kate and I were having a great time taking Polaroids with Robert. And then I bit her finger. She laughed. And because she laughed, I did it again. The second time, she did not laugh. With annoyance, she took her other hand, the one I hadn't bitten, and punched me on the back. "That really fucking hurt," she said. Then she bit me back. She grabbed my thumb and crunched right into it. This was the first time I had any inkling of how much I might hurt people when I bit them. Immediately, I transformed into a shamed nursery school kid. "Oh my gosh," I whispered. "I'm so sorry." I looked down at the little bit of blood on my thumb and thought, "Oh my God, this could